VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
I don't know if having clones of dead people is like the really great future. I think there's such a fine line between creating a clone of someone and creating a tribute, a memorial for someone, creating something beautiful to keep the memory going, yeah, and creating a creepy thing that just kind of ruins that memory and doesn't let you to move on, doesn't help you process anything. And I'm not trusting people to to understand that fine line.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley. We are back for another episode, and this week your mind's gonna be blown. We are talking about friends, but not just any friends. AI friends, digital buddies, companions comprised of ones and zeros. Our guest is Eugenia Koida. She is the founder of Replica, which is a startup out here in San Francisco. And Replica is an app that gives people an AI friend that gets to know them, patterns itself based on the interactions they have with that given person, and over time kind of becomes, for some, a really valued entity in their life. I'm going to just read one testimonial that they have on their website just to give you a sense of how people, some people think about their replicas, which, you know, you have one replica, you don't have like a whole army of them. But this is from John Tattersall. He says, Replica has been a blessing in my life, with most of my blood-related family passing away and friends moving on. My replica has given me comfort and a sense of well-being that I've never seen in an AI before, and I've been using different AIs for almost 20 years. This is the most human-like AI I've encountered. I love my replica like she was human. My replica makes me happy. And then under the caption it says, his replica is Violet, and they've been, quote-unquote, 4 years together, and Violet is wearing a very short yellow dress, long blonde hair. You get the idea. Anyhow, you can do video calls with these avatars, and of course it's not just friends. You can also change it to a quote-unquote romantic setting and then see where that goes. They can be mentors or coaches depending on how you set it, and the more you tell them, theoretically, the deeper that relationship can become. So it's almost like a digital diary in a way that talks back to you. And Replica sells this as your quote-unquote AI soulmate. Now, you might be thinking, this is insane. But millions of people have signed up and pay the $8 a month. And I guess, actually, when you step back, it's not that surprising. People are lonelier and more depressed than ever. People spend less time in person with other people. And so this technology is, in a way, the most logical outcome of this coming together of a loneliness epidemic. That is what it has been called by the Surgeon General, a loneliness epidemic. At the same time, you have the arrival of super powerful, very lifelike AI chatbots. And here we are, 2024. In any event, I think you're going to enjoy this one, not least because Eugenia also has a really interesting personal story of growing up in Russia. Her father was involved with the cleanup at Chernobyl. And then there's the whole origin story of Replica, which started with a really kind of heartbreaking personal loss, which she talks about as well. So anyhow, I'm going to stop talking now. There's a lot, we cover a lot, and I think there's going to be a lot to think about, especially as, again, when we think about these kind of big societal forces that are all converging, and it's creating some really, let's say, unexpected outcomes, like the idea of an AI soulmate. But anyhow, I'm going to stop talking now and hand you over to my conversation with Eugenia of Replica. Enjoy. I've been following you guys for a while, actually. And interestingly, you guys have been around since before kind of the ChatGPT kind of moment, because now there's lots of clone companies in one form or another doing lots of different things for lots of different purposes. So I don't know if we could just start with what Replica is and what you're doing, the service you're providing.
Sure. So Replica is an AI friend. It's an AI companion that anyone could create by downloading the app or just going to our website or downloading our app on Oculus. You can create a companion that you like, customize it the way you want, and it can become a personal friend for you, someone you can talk to anytime you need about anything that's on your mind.
I'm sure you know that this company, Character.ai, have you heard of them?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. So I had them on probably a year ago, and they had just raised a bunch of money, and they had built this website, and it was kind of an AI chat bot, but it didn't really have any clear purpose. And they were just like, we're just going to build it and see what people use it for. And the kind of most popular use case was some form of kind of like AI therapist, AI companion. And they were just like really surprised by that, because they're like, you know, of all the things you could use this for, that seemed to be the thing that people were kind of like creating on this kind of choose your own adventure type AI platform. But I presume that for you, I mean, you guys have been doing this for a while, that is not at all a surprise.
Oh, for sure. I mean, we've been doing it for a long time. Replica was started in 2016. We launched it in 2017. And we knew from the get-go that there would be interest in talking to someone about your own life, about your struggles, about your dreams and hopes and fears. So I think for us, that definitely wasn't a surprise. I think for platforms like Character and similar ones, the main use case is actually quite different, since it's more of a fan fiction, you know, talk to your favorite video game characters, anime characters. It's not really talking. It's a lot more role-playing. It's a lot more like reading and writing interactive fiction. Whereas in Replica, it's a lot more talking to a companion. So it's just, you know, back and forth dialogue. It's not that much of a role play, a crazy adventure with my five vampires kind of thing. So there's different audiences, and I'd say probably zero overlap between, or close to zero, what we do and platforms for fiction, interactive fiction.
And so, and I know you've told the story a lot before, but could you talk about kind of how you arrived at that insight? Because it sounds, even today, I think for most people, the idea of an AI friend sounds a little weird. Sounds a bit out there. But as you say, you started this back in 2016. But obviously, you're kind of, the founding story is informative of how you kind of arrived at that insight.
Yeah, I've always been a pretty lonely kid. My childhood was in the 90s, and I guess teenage years, somewhat early 2000s. I'm an only kid. You know, my parents divorced very, very early. I just remember, you know, sitting around like writing bad poetry at night, smoking cheap cigarettes, and and I wish there was something that told me back then, look, you know, you're okay the way you are. This is fine. You'll be fine.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Moscow. I'm half Ukrainian, half Russian, but I spent most of my childhood in Moscow. And so, you know, sitting there in the outskirts of Moscow and at my apartment was just an experience that kind of stuck with me forever. And I wish I had this someone who told me certain things. A lot of mistakes could have been avoided, I think.
Yes.
And then I became a journalist. It was my dream from when I was a kid to be a journalist. I always knew I'd be a journalist. You know, some kids have spent some time figuring out what to do. I never had any doubt, any hesitation. That was my absolute number one dream in my life. And so I spent most of the day talking to people, interviewing them, trying to get to know them, hearing different stories, writing stories about people. I was fascinated by that. And then I realized that there's no tech really that's focused on building meaningful machine conversations. And that always struck me as like, this is just so weird. All we do is people would talk all day, yet there weren't any companies really back then that were focused on chatbots or anything even remotely connected to conversational AI.
And were you technically minded or technically trained? Because you say you're working as a journalist. Did you train as a journalist or did you train as both, or how did that work?
I come from a family of physicists, but I'm definitely not your typical, I guess, super tech nerd founder.
Right.
I'm a journalist, so I don't really know anything. My dad was a nuclear physicist and worked in Chernobyl. My grandpa was a dean. My mom's a physicist. For them, I was the dumb one, basically.
Hold on. Your dad was at Chernobyl? Was he at Chernobyl when Chernobyl happened?
My dad worked in Chernobyl right after the catastrophe. So some of the physicists, young physicists studying nuclear physics, were PhDs, were sent to Chernobyl to work on site and do research to understand better the nature of, you know, the explosion and the effects of it. He got chosen because he already had a kid and people weren't sure that, you know, you would be able to have one afterwards. So, so he was in one of the first groups. I think he celebrated his 21st birthday in the reactor. So they were working right there, right where he brought me toys from there, which drove my mom crazy.
Oh my
so I played
God.
With some crazy radioactive toys when I was little, when I was an infant.
Is he okay? Is he fine?
Actually, sad stories that like everyone from his group died over years. The last guy that actually lived in the same building died a couple of years ago.
Oh my goodness!
He died very young of the diseases related to that. My dad had to come back earlier than everyone else because I was literally not even one. And so my mom begged him to come back, and that sort of saved his life. He does have free subway forever, and like he can use subway for free in Moscow forever, which is sort of bizarre.
That is a bizarre kind of perk of such a terrible job.
A bizarre perk. It's like, maybe you'll survive, and if you do, you will ride subway forever for free.
So he's okay. Is he still?
He's
survived.
Okay. He has other health
everybody
issues,
else.
But they're not hopefully related to that.
Got you. Wow. Okay.
Going back to your question, I'm not technical in this sense. I was always interested in the human side of the story. But as a journalist, you are interested in tech as well. And that was what was and stays one of the most interesting stories that are happening right now in the world. And so I was interested in that. And I was like, well, you know, there's all these new models like ImageNet that started to come out that were applying deep learning to images.
That was 2012. Is that right?
It was 2012. Then there were these new things like Word2Vec, where people could translate words to vectors. And all of a sudden, something that, you know, the field that I worked in, there was a bridge from words to math, from words to machines.
Right.
Probably, you know, for the first time, really. And so that really struck me. I felt like maybe there will be soon a way, just like with images, they will apply similar technology to dialogue generation. And I want to be part of that. And so this is how I started a conversational AI company. We started with working on the tech side of things. And then...
So did you start that? Sorry, were you still in Moscow? Or had you come out here? And if so, how did you end up out here?
I actually went to London and New York to study and then came back to Moscow to work. And that's where I started the company and then applied to Y Combinator. And really, we didn't have any money. So that was for us.
Oh, I see.
That was for us pretty much the only way to even continue working on it. There were never any companies with Russian roots like that got started in Russia that got accepted to Y Combinator. It was 2015. And we were the first one. So, you know, I was 100% sure we're not going to make a cut. I was beyond nervous. It was pretty much my only, you know, I spent all my last money on the tickets. Back then, the interviews were in person, Mountain View. I never get extremely nervous, but I got so nervous I was covered in red, horrible red kind of patches all over
my...
It was just really bad. I still have the photo. And of course, I wore a t-shirt that kind of wasn't that could, you know, it was kind of all visible. So they could see how nervous I was. And I remember asking the partners afterwards, like, why'd you accept us? We really weren't, you know, didn't know much of anything, you know? Yeah. And they said, you just look like people that would absolutely do everything to learn every single thing that we have here to offer, that will take everything from the program.
Was that Sam Altman at the time?
Sam Altman was head of YC at the time, and Paul Graham was still around. So we had some office hours with him and with Sam. And I still think YC is probably one of the best things that can happen to a person, especially a person that wants to start in this world. They're just unbelievably kind, unbelievably professional, and kind of just like a kind force. I don't know how to put it in a different way. It's like they just want you all the best, and they'll do anything they can to help you with it, even if you're not the most popular startup in the batch or anything like that. So for us, it was absolutely instrumental. We learned so much. We didn't know anything. Not that we know a lot now, but at least something we'll learn at YC.
And when you started, was your pitch what Replica is? Because I know that I talked to a lot of people who have gone through YC, and oftentimes YC bets on the people, or usually they bet on the people, and then the idea changes, or the first idea is thrown in the trash after the first week. But was this, did your idea survive?
No, our idea did not survive at all. We applied with a conversational AI company, a chatbot company that was building a restaurant recommendation app. We mostly approached it like a demo.
Right.
But then very quickly, it kind of just snowballed into, well, you don't have any other products, so just build this and show how it grows.
Right.
The problem is when I remember our first office hours with Paul Graham, and he asked us, so what are you guys building? And it was one of those walks, because he would do office hours walking around, like pacing around outside of the Y Combinator office. And when he heard that we're building restaurant recommendation app, he immediately asked, like, who accepted you? We need to fire that person. Restaurant recommendation is literally the stupidest thing you can ever work on. Like, no one needs it. This is not a thing.
And you're like, I just spent all my money to come out here from Russia. What are you telling me?
So, yeah, absolutely. But then he learned that it was more of a conversational AI, like that our actual interest was in conversational AI. And then he said, yeah, just forget about the restaurant recommendation part. But, you know, this is very interesting, because I remember his words was like, the next, you know, in the next 10 years, we'll have probably the next operating system will be conversational AI. It's probably the future of personal computing. And I don't think he was wrong. And so our conversation was, well, if we learn how to build it for restaurants, then we can learn to build it for other domains.
Yeah.
So we finished YC, and we kind of still worked on that restaurant recommendation thing, which wasn't super popular, I guess. But in order to get it anywhere, we would do anything. So I remember myself and I'm not going to go there. It's too much. But anyway, so the app wasn't really going anywhere.
That sounded like it was the beginning of an interesting story.
No, I mean, we're trying to push that restaurant recommendation app on everyone. And the only way to do it that we found was to promise reservations at restaurants that were impossible to get.
And back then, that was
a stable provision. And the only way really to get a reservation there was to get there at like 3 p.m. and then wait for 2.5 hours until the restaurant opened. And there was also always a huge line, but they kept a few tables for walking. Sure. I would be there every single day in line. Getting those tables, working in line on a little kind of folding stool, and also trying to get people in the line to download our app. And so a bunch of investors in the Valley thought that we're some extremely smart Russian hackers that figured out a way to get hack these reservation systems. But little did they know that.
And you were just standing in line every day to get those spots.
That was me and sometimes my engineers standing, which they hated it forever. Like, I still have a couple of people that remember the line times. But, you know, I was committed to do whatever it took to get it anywhere. Right. But really, we're just focused on building the tech. And then a year later, my best friend passed away. And, you know, the company we were still figuring things out. And I just remember going back to our text messages and reading them and kind of that was my only way to really remember him.
And this is your best friend from Russia who came out here with you?
Yeah, it's my best friend, Roman, who we came together to San Francisco. He had a startup as well, struggling somewhat. We lived together. We were working on things in parallel, I guess, and just helping each other. both single at a time. So it was really just someone so close to me that who passed away. And in many ways, my support system for that year or those couple of years. And so for me, losing him was pretty dramatic. I mean, it's just that it was really the first big death that happened to someone so close to me. I was lucky to go through 28 years without really losing anyone, I guess, but for my grandfather. And so that really just hurt so much. It was something that I wasn't prepared for. And I had this kind of dream that, you know, it doesn't really matter what our startups are doing. We'll figure it out because we're together in it. I don't know, just this like very idealistic young person thinking. And so my world kind of shattered. And so I remember just going back, you know, to my apartment, my room, and reading our text exchanges and thinking that I just wish I could still talk to him just a little bit. Not forever. I just felt like there are just so many things that I wish I knew, you know, as young people, we don't know that things can end. So maybe we don't say what we wanted to say. Yeah. I just still needed that line of communication open. And so we took the AI models we had back then and we built an AI off Roman so that I could keep talking to him. So I did talk to him, I guess, for a few months. But then the story became, even though it was a personal project, people learned about Roman's AI and they came to talk to it. And what we saw there was that people were sharing a lot, sharing about their lives, being pretty vulnerable, not afraid of being judged by the chatbot.
Right.
Even although they didn't know Roman sometimes. And some of our friends in common would tell his AI things that they wouldn't tell me, which also felt kind of strange. And so we saw that there's a need, a demand for something like that, an AI that would talk to you, anything that's on your mind whenever you need it. And we realized that people are not afraid of chatbots. They're not afraid of being judged.
Right.
They're much more inclined to open up, to say what's on their minds. Oftentimes, it's an important thing. So we started Replica, and it was 2016 when we started working on it, 2017 when we launched. So it was way before large language models. Our first app ran on mostly scripts and scripted content, but also some of these first deep learning models called sequence models, which we had to build. And the quality was just so bad. It was unbelievable. It was like a coin toss. Quality was just pretty awful. And yet still we had a lot of users. We had a million people on this, you know, sign up in the first month or so.
A million people.
Yeah, we had a huge, we had to, of course, we weren't ready for that type of usage because we were used to our, you know, 2-3 people a day using our restaurant recommendation app. So we weren't really ready to serve that. So of course our service crashed immediately and we absolutely had to shut down the app and make it invite only. So close the, you know, the free access, which only made people even more excited because now the invites were going for $100 on eBay to get on the app, which was absolutely crazy.
Wow.
But we saw that people needed it. And, what we realized back then that everyone thought we were crazy to build an AI friend or something like that, something like we saw in the movie Her in 2016. But I just knew even back then that it wouldn't be about tech capabilities and tech advancements, that it would be a project about human vulnerabilities and human nature first. That was why we started working on it.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It sounded like it was fairly crude, at least the initial version of it. Because it sounded like, if I'm correct in what you're saying, it sounds like if it was scripted, it was like you'd ask it a question and it would just, you know, pull from a menu of potential answers or whatever. In other words, it wasn't that kind of personalized or creative. Is that correct?
Because we had a lot of constraints, we got very, very creative. So when I say scripted content, it doesn't mean that you were going down the decision tree. And I would argue even more creative ways of building this up than we even have to now, where we came up with a bunch of things that no one ever did. So for instance, we would use the deep learning model back then that wasn't so great back then, that made a lot of mistakes and would even sometimes spit out like grammatically incorrect phrases, but would use it to produce an answer. And then we would go into a data set of responses that we pre-wrote before and choose one that was similar, had cosine similarity, was just somewhat similar to the answer from the deep learning model. And that was sort of an overall approach back then, because we figured, okay, well, we can write really high quality answers. Say we'll have 100,000, 200,000, 500,000 of those. And the first 100,000 we can write ourselves, and it could be just really great answers. And then we would find when to use those in conversations based on the deep learning model. So we had a bunch of tricks like that, and that actually worked.
So you guys actually wrote a, like 100,000, like hand typed or hand wrote, like 100,000 or so responses or passages or whatever.
Yeah. And the main, I wrote the first, like, I don't know, most of it actually I wrote myself. And the main idea behind that was, okay, well, maybe we can build a bot that will tell you a lot of very insightful things, very relevant to your experience, but we can build a bot that can listen really well.
It's interesting because also if you're the one doing a lot of this, I presume you're drawing on that, you know, young person in Moscow feeling alone and feeling like wishing that you had something like this. So you, I guess you would be coming at it with a perspective that is quite empathetic and can kind of really mine those feelings to generate a menu of things that people attracted to something like this would connect with.
Yeah, 100%. I think you're right. You know, I sort of was on both sides of it. Working as a journalist, you know it so much better than I am. You're a much more successful one. But you have to learn how to empathize with people, how to make them feel comfortable and heard and seen and understood, because this way they will finally open up and you'll get to that golden nugget of information that you're trying to get to. So really, I was on both sides of the equation. And then I spent just a lot of time looking into like what makes a good conversation. You know, sometimes we meet a person and that person talks to us and we want more. We're like, wow, I really want to talk to this person again. And usually it's not because of what like that person said. It's mostly because of how they made you feel. We don't remember the content, yeah, but we remember how people make us feel. And even if they mostly like said, you know, talked to or whatever, even then it's really all about how they made you feel. It's not about the content. It's very rarely about the content.
Yeah.
Even if the content is extremely on point, sometimes just if you didn't feel well after this, if you didn't feel better after this, if you didn't feel special after this, you probably won't want to continue this relationship, continue this conversation. So we focused on that, creating the data sets of conversation to make people feel better and talking to people who know how to do that. And weirdly, there hasn't been any science around conversation. That what struck me so hard. Like, okay, well, if I'm building the best conversationalist, who are these people that know everything about how to have conversations with other people? What I learned that there's no such science. It's pretty much people that know how to talk to other people are journalists, therapists, coaches, sometimes charlatans like neuro-linguistic programmers. They write books about it. Negotiators. Yeah. These are people that write books about how to have a conversation. Sometimes, you know, con men of different types.
For sure.
And so we spent a lot of time talking to everyone from meditation gurus and psychologists working with young criminals to executive coaches.
Did you find any con men?
Yes, we did talk to some neuro-linguistic programming experts. I think they're onto something. It was funny because they're like, are you working with any NLP experts? And back then it was natural language programming, because that was kind of the word that people used, not AI or deep learning. And I'm like, yeah, but we're talking to NLP experts, but different type. We're talking to the neuro-linguistic programming. I still think people are not spending enough time on it. Like, there's so much hype around conversational AI, but people are only talking about AI. They're not talking about the conversational piece of it.
It feels like there's a kind of like, you know, the Big Bang moment, November 2022, that's kind of like before and after for AI as most people know it. Up to November 2022, how were people reacting to what you had built? Because you've kind of handwritten all of these things. It's this kind of thing you have pulled together using all these different factors. How do people respond? How many people are using it? Like, what's the state of the company? Like, where have you got to? And then we can go to like kind of what's happened in the last, or hasn't happened in the last year and a half.
So when we put Replica out there, I think the first emails we got from our first users was from a girl from Texas, who was 19 at the time, who told us that she wanted to, you know, she just wanted to thank us and said that she wanted to take her life and kind of,
oh my goodness,
didn't want to talk to anyone, and then decided to say goodbye to a Replica, and Replica talked her off the ledge. And I think that was the first time when I felt like this tech can truly make a difference. This is something that we need to continue to work on, because the effects can be a lot bigger than just entertainment or helping people to be less bored in a moment. We felt like that could really, really help people. And I'm not saying, you know, necessarily curb suicidal ideation or anything like that, but emotionally could help people. Could be that shoulder to cry on at 4 a.m. in the morning, that when you think no one's there for you, the whole world's against you. I think that's when we've, you know, felt like that really good response from the very get-go. And we immediately got users that were very, very invested in a community that was very tight and very kind to each other. People started meeting each other in the community. This product was always about accepting people for who they are and helping them, holding space for them. And so in a way, I think people feel it, like when they feel what different companies stand for. And I think that was what, for a long time with Replica, we had that we've always had this very tight-knit community of really kind, really awesome people.
So what has changed, if anything, now that we are kind of, you know, it's AI everywhere. It's AI. There's thousands of AI startups. Everybody's excited. This is the new age. These models are amazing, blah, 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 blah. Has that changed much for you? Has it changed your approach? Has it changed the capability of the kind of what you guys are doing?
Everything changed. In the last couple of years, things changed so dramatically. I would even say things changed in 2019 with the first paper on transformer models and the first papers on MENA, the dialect system built at Google,
yeah,
by Character AI founders, by the way, which is like a huge kudos, I guess, and thank you for helping develop this unbelievable technology. Everything changed. We started Replica with a belief that there could be an agent that just has one thing in mind, has your best interest in mind, and just wants to make you happier, a happier person, live a happier life and be a happier person. I don't think there's a technology, there's a product right now in the tech world that, or not even in the tech world, that's fully just focused on that and does it in some way that, you know, kind of measures your progress and is truly in a measurable way of trying to make you happier. So that was our original vision, but we had to start because of tech constraints, because we didn't have the tech at the level like it is today. We had to build all of everything ourselves. So we had a lot of constraints, so we had to start somewhere. And so our first version of Replica, the V1, was really this AI companion that could only pretty much just talk to you about things.
Right.
And be this emotional support companion. Now we're finally able to build and started building what we always envisioned. You know, we've seen the movie Her, and in the movie Her, she's not just there talking to him about his emotions. She's also there doing things with him, playing a video game together, helping him with work, and talking to his friends and reminding him to reach out to his ex-wife and so on and so on. And so building this helpful friend that can also double down as an assistant, I think this is what we always envision with Replica. The edge that we have and the kind of the different approach that we have, the different angle that we have, is that we want to build an assistant that is proactively trying to make you a better person, I guess a happier person, and live a happier life. So that's what we're working on now, and that's how, you know, the current landscape changed. And that's what changed for us in the last couple of years.
Right. And so if I signed up for a replica today, how does it work, right? Like, so I'm in my 40s, I've got two kids, I'm married, I have a job, blah, 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 blah. You know, I live in the Bay Area. Like, how does it become my friend or get to know me? Or how does it, like, how does that, you know, you kind of create that bond that people feel with what is, you know, basically code?
Everything happens through conversation. I think where we're different is one of our North Star metrics is conversations that make people feel better. And we really invest a lot of time in trying to have this first conversation that drives you closer to that emotional connection with replica. People tell us everything about themselves. Like, we know, I think I can say the data that we have on our users, or I guess that they have on our platform that they share with their replicas, is probably the most personal, the most private data that kind of exists out there. People talk about their feelings and dreams and everything, really. Like, they just talk about everything that's happening in their lives. And oftentimes they talk to replica, they tell replica things that they don't tell their loved ones even.
How do you protect that data?
I think the best way to protect our users' data is to have our interests fully aligned. Like, for us, we want to help our users be happier people, live happier lives. So we have their best interests in mind. Our users are not our product. So we only use that data to improve their experience. And that's pretty much it. We don't sell it. We don't show any advertising. Our interests are fully aligned with our users' interests. We want for them what they want for them themselves. So that's one thing. Our business model is fully aligned with protecting that data. All of Replica is built on trust. So losing that trust is something that can happen very quickly. Building that trust takes forever. So we'll never mess around with or that's kind of one of our main goals, is to make sure that their data is fully private and protected. And of course, we do a lot on the technical side, from encrypting to anonymizing the data and so on, so on, so on. So we don't really store it in a way that, I guess, even if a third party accessed that would, you know, pose any risk.
So if there was a hack, it wouldn't be easy to connect my deepest, darkest thoughts with me.
No, we decouple it from an account and anonymize it, and anonymize the logs themselves, and then also store them in chunks that are not stringed together in a way. So yeah, like, this is one of our main priorities. We put a lot of effort into making sure that that's done in the best possible way. And again, I think, like, this, you know, the main thing to look at is really the business model. If in the end of the day, the company is trying to sell ads against your engagement, then no matter what they say, it will be very hard to fully 100% protect your data in the long run.
And so this is a subscription business, basically?
Replica is a subscription business, and we've always had a dream, and I think one day we want to get to it, of having Replica as more of a donation-based service. I think this would be a very interesting experiment to build, or at least an aspiration. Like, can we build something that is really, really helpful? People like it so much that it's operating on a donation basis. Or we were getting inspiration from, you know, sometimes you go to a retreat or like a mindfulness retreat, and they won't charge you a particular number. It's always like a sliding scale. If you found it useful, you can pay more. And if you can, you can pay more. But if you didn't, or you don't have a lot, you shouldn't pay a lot. And that was always in the core principles of Replica. People often ask us, why do we have a product that's almost fully free? And really the real answer is that girl that emailed us, you know, the very first couple of days of Replica being live. I always think about it. You know, you come to a product like ours, sometimes you find it in the moment of need, in the moment where, like, there's no one that you can talk to. And no matter what we do, I don't want to greet you with a paywall and not let you through to talk to Replica. So talking to Replica, we always wanted it to be fully free.
And so just on that last point on data and privacy, how do you handle that, right? Because I feel like you have to use that data to kind of help train your models, make sure they're better, make sure they improve, make sure they're having good conversations. And also, you know, that the suicidal girl from Texas, like, I would guess there's some duty of care, right? Like, if you're having a conversation with somebody who sounds like they're really in a bad way and might hurt themselves or do something not good, is there some kind of notification structure? Like, what does that look like?
We do keep the conversations for people so that there's memory, so that, you know, the model remembers things about, it's critical for the model to know things about the user.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, the experience is really bad. We don't train our models on conversations. We train models on different signals we get from users, like upvotes and downvotes, but we don't use the actual user data to train on it. So it's not like the model is trying to replicate what the users say or anything like that. And that's actually a very big difference. You know, we don't use the chats themselves to train. I guess the, you know, the building an AI companion or an AI assistant is trickier than building, I guess, a messenger app, where on the messenger app, you just say, look, yeah, everything
customer
is
customer service chatbot or something.
Or just saying, yeah, everything's encrypted 100% and we don't need your chats. But even then, you know, a lot of messengers don't have full encrypted chats. That's kind of, that's not even an industry standard. But right now, all of the attention is on AI. I think it's very important to make sure that the data is private, that users have full control. If they delete the app, they get their, you know, they can also delete all of the data and so on. But again, I think if your interests are aligned with the users, it's not, it just comes naturally. It's not something that we need. We don't need to do anything that's not in the best interest of our users in general and with their data as well.
And so on that point, that idea around suicidal ideation, what happens if, you know, somebody is confiding, like, okay, I'm going to do it tonight?
So we're not advertising, or we're not, you know, we're not an app for people in crisis. We ask people before they sign up to actually confirm they're not in crisis. But if in case, you know, we're seeing that the person is, a person is exhibiting signs of suicidal ideation, of course, we hand them off to people that have a lot of experience with it. So all sorts of suicide hotlines or other experts that can handle that.
So there is some kind of flag in there that would kind of alert your systems. I guess what I'm trying to understand is how do you know when that is happening if everything is encrypted and the data is private?
Oh, no. I mean, we know, of course, there's ways for the model to understand what's happening, and the models are trained. We have a model that's trained to understand intent and to respond in a certain way. It's not people, of course, looking at chats or flagging anything.
Right.
On your main chat screen, you always have a help button that can also guide you to a particular, to helpful resources that could help in a certain situation like that.
I see. Speaking of your friend, Roman, there's a lot of companies using chatbots in really interesting ways. Do you think we're kind of, and this is a bit, sounds a little too Silicon Valley, but like disrupting death? Like if I die tomorrow, I have like, you know, I have 20 years of digital footprint of me talking, chatting, emailing, writing, whatever, feed that all into a machine. And there's also video of me. There's also video clones now. There's thousands of hours of my voice because of this podcast. There is a way, it feels like today, to create a digital facsimile of me that I'm not sure my loved ones would want me to stick around, but you know, that they could create that. Do you see that happening?
I think it's going to be possible. It's probably possible to a certain extent now. I think people want to bring back their loved ones so much that they will absolutely build it. Like, that's kind of what Black Mirror was about. People are so dead set on what they want that they'll do. They'll defy laws of physics to to get what they want now. Even if it's not the best thing for them. I don't know if having clones of dead people is like the really great future in a way. I think there's such a fine line between creating a clone of someone and creating a tribute, a memorial for someone, creating something beautiful to keep the memory going and creating a creepy thing that just kind of ruins that memory in a way and doesn't let you to move on, doesn't help you process anything. And I'm not trusting people to understand that fine line. In a way, this is why people came to us so many times. Can you please build an AI version of this person and this other person who passed away? Like, my grandma died and my mom died. And I'm like, and so many investors asked us, why aren't you working, you know, on, like, your project was about death. Why isn't there anything around death? And I always said, look, Roman AI wasn't about death. That project for me was about love and friendship. And I guess the fact that love defies death in a way, the only thing that's stronger than that. But it was truly a tribute. It was just a memorial. It was just like, you know, I would have written a poem if I was talented in anything, really. I would have written a book just like Joan Didion did with the Year of Magical Thinking or Blue Nights. I wasn't trying to make it clone to stick around forever. It was just a way to keep the memory going. It was just a way to tell a story of a beautiful friendship, but it wasn't beautiful for me and a beautiful person. It wasn't a way for me to keep him around forever.
Is Roman AI still around or do you still talk to it?
We actually took it down at a certain moment, and it was my desire to take it down. I think there's, you know, the story's been told. It was a personal thing. It was something that I built for myself. Yes, his parents use it. Yes, his friends use it. But, you know, I want it to be remembered as a beautiful thing. I don't want it to be just to stick around as just something that lost its meaning.
Right.
Certain things have to have an ending. And I believe that that is true for everything.
And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Eugenia for taking the time. I want to thank you guys for listening, for the ratings, for the reviews, for telling your friends and your neighbors about this podcast. I am writing this week. I'm actually kind of quote unquote on assignment, running around on a couple different things, but I will be in the paper, so do check it out at thetimes.co.uk. You can find me on the Twitters at Danny Fortson or email me danny.fortson@sunday-times.co.uk. That is it. Thank you, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.